Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. On Friday, May 6, partners from across the Mid-Atlantic region gathered together for the inaugural Regional Domestic Terrorism Conference in New Brunswick, New Jersey, to discuss how law enforcement and homeland security professionals may counter the current threat of domestic terrorism. This event, hosted by our office, the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, in coordination with the New Jersey Regional Intelligence Academy, provided a forum for various organizations from various states to report on the terrorist threat that exists in the United States and in their jurisdictions. Over the next few weeks, you'll hear from experts in the field, to include Clint Watts, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, J.M. Berger, a senior fellow from George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, as well as J.J. McNabb, also a fellow from George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. You'll also hear from some of our regional partners, like Liberty Day from the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, more commonly known as START, from the University of Maryland. And finally, Thomas Brzezowski, Counsel for Domestic Terrorism Matters from the U.S. Department of Justice.
Hello, everyone. This is Jenna Raymond. I'm an intelligence analyst at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Today, I am joined by Thomas Brzezowski. Mr. Brzezowski currently serves as the Counsel for Domestic Terrorism in the Counterterrorism Section of the U.S. Department of Justice. He received his bachelor's degree in international relations from the College of William and Mary in 1996, after which he immediately was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. Mr. Brzezowski spent 3 years as an artillery officer at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, before he was selected to attend law school under the auspices of the U.S. Army-funded legal education program. After law school, he spent 6 years in Europe, serving as an officer in the U.S. Army JAG Corps. He then left active duty and clerked for Judge Stanley Birch Jr. at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta, Georgia. Prior to taking up his present position, Mr. Brzezowski was an assistant general counsel in the FBI's Office of the General Counsel. He also serves as a military judge in the U.S. Army Reserves. He's married and has 3 sons, which sounds like a handful in addition to his work duties. So, if we could just jump right in, I'd like to ask you about the Domestic Terrorism Council. Why was the Domestic Terrorism Council created, and what is its mission?
So, the Department of Justice's highest priority is combating terrorism, both international and domestic, and other threats to our national security in order to protect the American public. We strive to remain nimble so we can adjust to current threats as they evolve and new threats emerge. The National Security Division created the Domestic Terrorism Council in recognition of the growing number of potential domestic terrorism matters around the country, and to ensure that we maximize the benefits of information and input from the eyes on the ground from around the country. This Domestic Terrorism Council plays a key role in the National Security Division's headquarters-level efforts to identify trends to help shape our strategy and to analyze legal gaps or enhancements required to combat these threats.
So, when we look at domestic terrorism, what sorts of challenges does domestic terrorism pose that we might not see with international terrorism?
Right. So, we've seen that many domestic terrorist attacks are carried out by lone offenders attempting to promote their own grievance or agenda. Now, these individuals are typically motivated by a variety of ideologies, such as the anti-government views that spurred Timothy McVeigh to carry out the Oklahoma City bombing of a federal facility, as well as a host of other pernicious, hateful philosophies. In the United States, as you know, harboring extremist views is not itself a crime, nor is the expression of even a hateful ideology. But when individuals and groups espousing such viewpoints use violence to advance them, their actions cross a line. And we recognize that the threat of domestic terrorism is real, and it's growing. And disrupting such individuals and groups before they have an opportunity to engage in violence has always been a challenge to us, and always will be a priority for us. And we're going to continue to use every tool at our disposal to deter and disrupt the threat.
When the Domestic Terrorism Council position was announced in October, Assistant Attorney General John P. Carlin said it was designed to identify trends to help shape our strategy and to analyze legal gaps or enhancements required to ensure we can combat these threats. I know it's only been a few months, but are there any gaps or opportunities that you've already been able to identify?
Right. Well, the first order of business is to take a look at the information that we do have available to ensure that we're working with a data set that accurately reflects the breadth, depth, and scope of the domestic terrorism threat. At that point, we intend to analyze the data with a view towards identifying trends and potential gaps. One of the things that we're looking at is whether a federal statute targeting ideologically motivated crimes of violence makes sense. That process is still ongoing. We have already identified numerous opportunities to better understand and confront the domestic terrorism threat through coordination and outreach to state, local, and federal partners who work on domestic terrorism matters. In addition to public safety outreach, we have also coordinated with numerous groups and organizations outside the government, folks like think tanks, academic institutions, and non-governmental organizations. And these efforts have been informative and productive, and we have across-the-board commitments to collaboratively identify, confront, and deter the threat of domestic terrorism, regardless of what form it comes in.
Okay, so you just mentioned, you know, there's no domestic terrorism statute under which, you know, an individual can be charged. Usually people are charged with a hate crime, homicide, weapons charges, or, you know, fraud or tax crimes. Does that make it easier or more difficult for us to identify, disrupt, and prosecute domestic terrorists? And, you know, do we need a domestic terrorism statute?
Well, again, the specific charges brought in a particular case are highly dependent on the facts and circumstances presented. Now, as you correctly note, domestic terrorism is not itself an offense in the criminal code. Instead, we have the entire criminal codebook at our disposal. Now, over the years, the Department of Justice has successfully charged violent extremists of all types with a wide variety of crimes, ranging from firearms or explosives offenses to arson, threats or fraud, tax violations, or hate crimes and murder. That said, we are taking a hard look at all of our cases and all available intelligence to identify and analyze whether there are legal gaps that need to be addressed or enhancements required to combat those threats.
I read that Attorney General Loretta Lynch has called hate crimes the original domestic terrorism. However, we still differentiate between hate crimes and terrorism for legal and prosecutorial reasons. Are those distinctions still useful, or should we start thinking about them in other ways?
Right, yeah. The relationship between hate crimes and domestic terrorism is a close one. From a legal perspective, distinguishing between the two concepts, in my view, still makes sense. In the federal system, the term hate crime refers to a specific statutory violation, whereas domestic terrorism is a definition, not a separate, standalone criminal offense. So in practice, this means that a hate crime can also meet the definition of domestic terrorism. The terms are not mutually exclusive. For example, the Charleston shooting could be charged as a federal hate crime and also be characterized as domestic terrorism.
I know for our office, I cover homegrown violent extremists, and a lot of these HVs end up being charged with material support, which includes traveling or attempting to travel to join a foreign terrorist organization. Sometimes it can be propaganda support, financial support, or providing weaponry. The material support charge right now is exclusively used to prosecute people who are directed or influenced by a foreign terrorist organization. Do we need to have a domestic terrorism charge for material support?
That's a complicated topic to answer briefly.
Yeah.
But in short, I don't think so. I think such a statute would require the creation of a domestic terrorism organization list, analogous to the foreign terrorist organization list presently maintained by the U.S. Department of State. The Supreme Court has signaled that such a list likely would not be constitutional. That said, the Department of Justice can use several other laws to target domestic terrorist groups, laws like conspiracy, or a statute that criminalizes teaching or distributing bomb-making information in support of federal crimes of violence, for example.
We've seen a lot of domestic terrorists affiliate themselves with broader and law-abiding social or protest movements in the past. How can we best identify and minimize the threat they pose while still maintaining people's constitutional rights?
As in any area of the law, we execute our responsibility to investigate and charge cases consistent with the Constitution we have sworn to defend. So the Department of Justice will continue to use proactive enforcement tools and investigative techniques, including the use of undercover operations, to stay ahead of the threat. Undertaken with careful oversight and with appropriate respect for civil rights and liberties, these tools can be highly effective.
I want to talk a little bit about countering violent extremism programs, which is sort of an emerging and important topic. So how does the Domestic Terrorism Council fit in with our efforts to counter violent extremism at federal and local levels?
Well, I've already met with the recently formed Countering Violent Extremist Task Force at the federal level. It's currently housed at the Department of Homeland Security several times to discuss domestic terrorism issues. The most important thing that I can do to support the task force is to educate it on some of the subtleties and ambiguities associated with domestic terrorism investigations and prosecutions. The better the CVE task force understands the nature of the domestic terrorism threat, the more equipped they are to counter violent extremism of all stripes, including domestic extremism.
Can you talk a little bit about the philosophy that the Department of Justice is going to take towards CVE programs?
Right. At this point, I think it's probably more appropriate for me to defer that question to the Countering Violent Extremist Task Force itself.
Okay, good. Now I have our next podcast.
There you go.
So, you know, since I work for a state agency, what role do states and local jurisdictions have in complementing the work that you're doing with the Domestic Terrorism Council?
Well, state and local jurisdictions are an integral part of the larger effort to combat domestic terrorism. Our local U.S. attorney's offices and FBI field offices work closely with our nation's police officers, district attorneys, and local officials in communities across the United States who are our eyes on the ground. The FBI leads the joint task forces in each of the 56 field offices that work with a variety of federal, state, territorial, and tribal partner agencies to address terror threats of all kinds. And the FBI provides investigative and intelligence support to local law enforcement and prosecutors when domestic terrorism cases are prosecuted at the local level.
And then, I guess just lastly, we always like to know what our experts are sort of looking at and reading. So can you recommend anything to anyone listening who might be interested in learning more about domestic terrorism?
Absolutely. In my effort to better understand the genesis of domestic terrorism and its long history in the United States, I've been reading Beverly Gage's The Day Wall Street Exploded. It's a fascinating look at the largely forgotten time in which the threat of domestic terrorism was ever present, and it serves as a reminder that domestic terrorism is not a new phenomenon, but has been with us since America was founded, almost 240 years ago. Another source, or a valuable resource, to appreciate our current federal framework with regard to domestic terrorism is the final report of the Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities. It's a lot, but it's also known as the Church Committee Report. And although sometimes a shocking read, it best illustrates how we arrived at where we are today in terms of the federal approach to domestic terrorism.
Was it published relatively recently?
Or? Oh, no, this is out of the 70s.
Oh, okay.
So it kind of charts some of the missteps that the federal mm-hmm. government took leading up to the early 70s in connection with domestic intelligence activities. And there's a lot to be learned in terms of what we did in the past, and it should inform how we structure where we go in the future.
Sounds like if someone read that and then compared it to what we've done from the 70s until now, see if we learned from any of those mistakes
yeah,
or
think,
kind of repeated some.
I think it's probably, in the main, I think we've learned quite a bit. Because you also have to understand that in the aftermath of the Church Committee, there were a number of statutes that were passed that have direct bearing on how the United States conducts its domestic intelligence activities. The primary one that comes to mind is the Privacy Act, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in conjunction with several other regulatory provisions that stemmed from the Church Committee report, to include the Attorney General's guidelines, really fundamentally altered how the United States goes about looking at domestic terrorism at the federal level.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.